Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. When children love learning, they can tackle any challenge life throws at them. Sylvan's Insight Assessment can help you determine if your child is ready for what's ahead. It can also identify gaps in learning and point out areas that could be of concern for your child so they can tackle what's to come. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
Hello, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm here with my co-hosts, Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Hey.
Hey, guys.
Hey. Hey there.
We're taping an episode again because we're not allowed to talk about people who've snubbed the show in the introduction of the show. That's actually a special premium feature. Behind the scenes look at people who've said no to coming on this podcast.
We've got hours of tape.
It's really a delight.
Grapecast.
Let's talk about someone who did not snub us.
Yeah.
Came on the show, although he did make me come to his office. This week's guest.
I give that a half a snub.
It was a really nice office. I went to Ezra Klein's office at Vox in Washington, D.C. He's got a big, like, panoramic view of the Washington Monument. And it was great. He, in addition to being the co-founder and editor of Vox, has a podcast, which I enjoy. I think he's a good interviewer. And we talked a little bit about that and starting Vox and how he got his start at the Post. And he was great. He was really he's an interesting guy.
As always, we are sponsored by MailChimp. If you have a business that needs to stay in touch with the people who use your business, I suggest using MailChimp to do so with an email newsletter. They make the best one. Thank you, MailChimp.
And now here's Max with Ezra Klein.
How do you think about your time? You're now like you're a boss.
Yeah.
You're the boss.
Yeah, I've made terrible mistakes.
You're the boss now. How do you think about your time? Like doing the podcast, do you do the podcast every week?
Yeah, two of them.
Two podcasts a week.
Yeah. I do that because I needed to start doing some kind of creative product that I could control. Because I really do try to take running Vox seriously, and that means I do not get to spend my days reporting and writing. It isn't that I do no writing, but I really don't do the amount of reporting and research I used to do. Mm-hmm. Podcasting, first, I really love it because I've always really loved interviews, and it's just a medium that is really conducive to that. But it is something that I can put on the calendar and time box.
Right.
And because I can do that and because I can plan around it in advance, I can do it. Mm-hmm. But what I like about podcasting is that you can be wrong.
You don't think you can be wrong in the other various mediums of your life?
I used to be able to.
No longer?
The great thing about blogging when I was starting out and nobody gave a shit what I thought about anything was I could be wrong all the time. And I was. My career is built on being wrong as a college student. And that was really great because you could work out ideas. You know, you could try things out. I mean, there was something you could do that I could do as a blogger where there would be something that interested me about the world. I would write up just like a theory on it, a riff. And then some people come in the comments and be like, that's not correct. There's all this research that you haven't read. I'd be like, oh, great. I learned something today. And now, you know, I'm a professional journalist. So you do that and, you know, you're ill-serving the audience. You can't just like go out and riff and try on new ideas. And on the one hand, I'm not saying that's bad. I think it's, you know, appropriate for what I'm doing. But it is fun to be able to just try things on. And podcasting, for reasons I don't quite understand, retains that sense of the individual mm-hmm. where people will accept that you were speculating, that you were trying something on for size, that you were, you know, just going back and forth. On The Weeds, which is the policy podcast I do with Matt Iglesias and Sarah Cliff, I'm constantly coming up with an idea that they then just like completely talk me out of in the next rebuttal. And that's fine. And nobody emails and like, well, fuck you. You right. were wrong about that off the cuff reaction to the thing they said. But in text, you know, I can't do that anymore. And I miss it.
Yeah. Do you
aside from like having your mitts on something creative that also doesn't steal all your time, do you like doing it?
Yeah, I love it.
Do you think you're getting better at it?
No, I think I'm like holding exactly steady. But I've only done, I think, in terms of the interview show. So I have two. I have The Weeds, which is a policy discussion with Iglesias and Sarah Cleff. And then I have The Ezra Klein Show, which I always feel sheepish saying. But I really do enjoy doing it. I don't know if I'm getting better yet. I'm trying out a bunch of new things. So I just did an interview, and I don't know if it'll come out before or after. This comes out with Jesse Eisenberg. That's the first time I've ever interviewed an actor.
Mm.
And the interview went totally fucking great.
Great.
But at this point, it really feels to me that whether an interview goes well is not something that I have a lot of control over. Like, I don't feel in command of that progression.
Mm-hmm.
There have definitely been interviews that I walked into exactly as prepared, probably more prepared, and I just could not get them into that space.
What do you think makes a good interview?
What makes a good interview? Emotional openness and intellectual openness, and then some kind of connection based on people enjoying talking to each other. Mm-hmm. So basically, I think that you can have an interview where the two people like each other, but one or the other is either being emotionally or intellectually closed. So we could have a super fun connection, but I could stay completely on talking points.
Yeah.
And it won't be a good podcast. Conversely, I think you can have a great intellectual or emotional openness, but you never connect. So the whole conversation is kind of stilted and formal, and that won't work. So you end up needing to be in this weird space where you're able to develop some kind of very fast, near friendship, and combine that with people like actually just being willing to talk. And because my podcast is just like a rambling, unstructured mess, where the idea is that you'll get to sort of live inside somebody's head for a little while, if you're not willing to go off in weird directions, it's just going to be a very uncomfortable experience for everybody.
Yeah.
And one weird thing about podcasting, which I don't like compared to writing, is that I feel pretty calm killing a piece. But when you go and take an hour or 90 minutes or 2 hours of somebody's time, I don't feel like you can just say, well, that didn't really turn out that good, so I'm not releasing it. So I wish sometimes that there was some way to signal to the audience, I don't really think you should listen to this one.
This one's a skip.
Like, there needs to be some kind of secret code. Like, if the in the iTunes description, if the first letter of every sentence spells out, don't listen.
Right. So sort of like podcast Ouija board.
Right.
Let's talk about being a boss.
Sure.
Do you like it?
I like parts of it.
What do you like?
So I really like building an organization. And I really, really, really like and have sort of always really liked trying to figure out how we can do the kinds of journalism that I'm really passionate about better. Not saying we always succeed, but it's really a lot of fun to get to test out theories of, well, if we did this, then could we do more great pieces, or could we create something that the audience understands better? So all that stuff where you're strategizing and trying to think about how to cover things, like the actual work of being an editor, of being a story assigner, of being, of having this ability to take ideas and really put them into play, I like that a lot. The other side of it, right, is that you have a lot of meetings. You know, you have personnel stuff, which is not always the most fun. Like, you're, a lot of people's happiness or even their paychecks are responsible on you not screwing things up.
Yeah.
And that stuff is difficult. You know, and you try to do your best at it.
But that's not, like, you don't wake up in the morning excited about managing people.
Not as an end in and of itself.
Yeah.
The most exciting thing in my job is when folks I manage just do awesome things. Like, the further it gets from me, the happier I am about it. You know, our video team just creates marvels all the time.
Shout out to Joe Posner.
Shout out to Joe Posner and Joss Fong. And I'm always so incredibly proud of that work, in large part because I have so little to do with it or to contribute towards it. And that's stuff where you feel like, oh my God, we've built this tremendous organization that has these fundamental values and has these capabilities and has this orientation. and it's created a context for these great things to happen. That kind of managing people is fantastic.
I want to talk to you about how you got here. And at least from afar, one of the stories of how you got here is pretty relentless sort of ambition and self-starting and going hard yourself at projects, at ideas, at work. And I wonder whether it's been challenging at all to manage people who maybe aren't wired exactly that way.
It's funny because, I totally know that narrative about myself. And
I mean, feel free to say that narrative is off, too.
Well, I'm not going to say it's off. I'm going to say that the part of it that I never quite know how to think about emotionally in terms of how does it help me understand what I'm doing or how to manage people or whatever is that none of it ever felt that way. I have had so much the opposite of a five-year plan. I started blogging when like nobody ever imagined that would be a career path for anybody. And I started it as a lark. And everybody around me thought I'd become a journalist before I did. So like I just never intended to go into journalism. Like almost until the day I did it, I thought I'd go to law school or whatever. And then when I was a journalist, when I started out particularly as a blogger, I never had like the slightest intention of going into editing, much less into management. And it's always felt to me, the way my career has gone, that the next thing has presented itself really obviously, that there's been some limit I hit, and that in order to then do the kind of work that I felt would be the work that I should be doing, I had to build something or go somewhere or do something different. And in each case, I mean, it felt like the change was driven by that. I went to the Washington Post in 2009, and I was there as a blogger and a sort of policy blogger. And 2011, I had the great fortune to start Wonk Blog there. But it wasn't that I came in 2009 with the intention of ever running a section or having anybody working under me. Like it never occurred to me that would ever happen in my career. It wasn't yet actually something I really wanted. But I had been covering Obamacare, and I was covering the financial bill. And as I moved from one to the other, I knew there were all these Obamacare stories that I cared about and I knew my audience cared about, but I couldn't cover them, right? Because I was now doing the debt ceiling crisis. I was now doing Dodd-Frank. And so it was just obvious if I was going to provide the audience with the service that I thought I was supposed to be providing them with, then I needed more people.
Right.
Because I knew what the stories were. I just literally couldn't get to them. And so that was how Wonk Blog happened. It was like I saw the need in my own work and like in my own relationship with the readership. And it was just, you know, the obvious thing you would do is hire people on to do it. And with Vox, it was actually, you know, in my experience of it, pretty similar. It has just always, always, always bugged me that we were so bad at providing baseline context that, and I think it's because of the things I covered. When you're doing incremental coverage of something like Obamacare, the emails you get are not what happened today in Obamacare. It's like, how do subsidies work? Like, what the fuck is this thing? And I had nowhere to point people.
Right.
Like to Wikipedia. Like, where did the information about what it was live? Mm-hmm. And so the idea for Vox emerged out of how do I solve that problem? How do I not have everything we know about Obamacare or Dodd-Frank or the debt ceiling or whatever fractured across 10,000 stories? So I'm not saying there's not ambition, but it isn't goal-directed in that way. It's sort of I get really into covering things and then get really frustrated because I can't cover them the way I think they should be covered. And then I try to build the thing that will solve the problem.
So what you're saying is it wasn't strategic. It wasn't that where I want to be is running a section at the Post, where I want to be is running my own, you know, news operation. It was born out of seeing some hole in the market, some hole in your own reporting, something you wanted to do that you couldn't do without doing that other thing.
Yeah, it's born out of annoyance usually.
Born out of annoyance. So even taking that, I mean, that even that instinct, if it's not necessarily like entrepreneurial in the way that mm-hmm. I was describing it before, it is like affecting change in your own life, right? It is like not accepting the parameters of where you are and trying to figure mm-hmm. out how to change the dynamic around what you're doing, to expand what you're doing, to like push and see how far you can push and create space to do more, right? So that gets back to the original question, I guess. Like, not everyone is wired that way. I think the thing I'm trying to ask is there's a transition from being the person who's doing the work to trying to build an organization that does that work, and has been hard, has been a challenge to not everyone is going to be wired that way. Not everyone's going to see it. I'm not surprised that your answer was like, I love it when people do stuff that I'm not connected to at all, because that's kind of like how you're wired.
That's super interesting.
And so my question is like, what do you do? Is it hard for you to work with people who are not wired that way?
No, which isn't to say there isn't anybody it's hard for me to work with. It's only to say that I don't think by any means like that is the only way to do good work. So I really, really, really like working with writers and editors. And I'm not, for the most part, asking them or even looking for them to try to start new sections or organizations. I mean, sometimes, but I have no problem with someone who what they want to do is their job. I do find it hard when people aren't hungry. Not when they're not hungry to change things, when they're not hungry on their own beat, when they're not hungry in their own space. I have always had a tendency to throw myself at the story and to try to expand the boundaries of what I could cover, you know, to try to think of ways that, you know, if it's a political story, I can make it a policy story. If it's a completely non-political story, non-policy story, I can use the tools, maybe a policy analysis, to take it on. You know, I would try to find ways to cover things like the Boston bombing, even though I was working on a policy blog. And that's something that I prize in folks and try to push. I don't want people to say, well, nothing happened on my beat today. I don't have to do anything. I want people to have that desire to be on the page.
Is that something you think is innate, or is that something you can learn how to do?
I often think it has to do with people finding the right space for them. Something that is very key to my psychology about this stuff is that until I was 19, 20, something like that, I was a complete slacker, like did very badly in high school, was like a really like my whole like reputation, both externally but also internally with myself, was like a not hard worker who kept failing at things. And so I have a very, very clear sense that in another context, I really do poorly. And so I only became hungry when I was in a space and in a situation where what I was doing matched what I was good at, what I could focus on. It just somehow eventually I found something where the different parts of me clicked. But I have a really deep understanding that you actually have to find that for that experience to be smooth.
This is going to be a very awkward segue. Sure. But speaking of hunger, I read this thing about you that like you were a fat kid.
Yeah.
And like when you're 17 or something, and you decided like you just didn't want to be that person anymore?
I mean, I think that is overstating how that worked out. But when I was 16, I think it was, there were a whole host of reasons, including being rejected by a girl I liked and all kinds of shit. But also having been made fun of for being fat for whatever it was at that point, 10 years. And yeah, at that point, I lost a lot of weight.
Like ate the same thing every day and ran 3 miles every day. That feels to me connected to what we're talking about on some level. Like most 16-year-olds don't have the drive to do that, I think. Or maybe it's not drive. I don't know. What was it?
Well, but I think if you had looked around, certainly the way I understood my role in the world or personality at that point,
yeah,
every 16-year-old I knew seemed to have more drive and discipline than I did. I was the one fucking up in my classes. I was shit at sports. couldn't seem to pay attention to things. So I agree, like in that moment, I showed a lot of discipline. And it came out of, you know, what as a high schooler you experience is sort of an emotional trauma.
The most important thing.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But if you had polled 50 people who knew me, every one of them would have given the same answer, which is that I had way less than the normal capacity for discipline, way less than the normal capacity for hard work, way less ability to focus on things that maybe I didn't exactly want to focus on. why I lost a lot of weight at that point, I don't exactly know. It worked out well, but it was at that time unprecedented and would remain a somewhat isolated incident of rising to the occasion for a number of years.
But then so what I'm hearing you say is it's not necessarily that the people that you've encountered who don't have that hunger simply don't have that hunger.
Right.
It's that they haven't met the thing that's going to sort of activate it.
Right, or at least that tends to be my assumption. Mm-hmm. Right, I think that if you've fought to get into journalism and fought to end up at a place like Vox, there is probably some union between you and work and subject that will lead you to really want to be in the game. And if we haven't found that, we have to keep trying. But the people who are here are pretty fucking hard workers.
Mm-hmm.
And so when there's some kind of blockage, it's usually because we are not finding the approach to writing and the kinds of topics and maybe the manager and so on that will make that easy. And I know a lot of people. I've seen a lot of people who in one context in journalism are very kind of paralyzed and are having a lot of trouble getting things out onto the page. And then you put them in another context and things work out really well. I've watched a lot of people go from having a lot of trouble in a sort of formal bureaucratic structure to having some kind of blog and all of a sudden it unleashes. Mm-hmm. Or I've seen people do the opposite too. I've seen people suddenly go from having, you know, real management and an editor standing over them over to something where they have a lot of freedom and they totally freak out.
Right.
So I do think it's like really important to find the way you work best.
And for you, it sounds like you found that pretty quickly.
Yeah. Once I found blogging, I was in college. I was in my freshman year at UC Santa Cruz. And immediately I was just writing 10 things a day. And again, like it was a surprise to me too. And I was waking up at 7 a.m. to make sure I had content on the site really early. I mean, like I really got into it very quickly.
Did you have an audience quickly?
No. So I got in and I got into it because I liked reading the blog of this guy, Matt Iglesias. And I figured if this college kid could do it, like, why couldn't I try? And I emailed him and he linked to me. He was very kind. And I was so excited. And like for the longest time, I had 30 people a day. I had my site meter, I think mm-hmm. it was called.
Yeah.
And it said like it would vary between 30 and 40. And right. if I got like a link from Matt, it would bring in 120 people or something. Right. And I was like fucking thrilled.
We're going to the bar.
Yeah, exactly. Well, not then, but. and I didn't have any sizable audience for years still after that. I was on Pentagon for a while. Like that got into like the low, I think we were in the low thousands. Mm-hmm. I then went to my own site that stayed in the low thousands.
When you were in like the 30s, 40s, 120 day was awesome. You were still waking up at 7 and being got to make it fresh.
Awesome.
Feed the maw.
Yeah. Also, it turns out I just really like the work of writing. I mean, reading and researching and thinking about the world and writing about it is just really pleasurable to me. But also, I mean, what was nice about that was the stakes were so low. I was a college kid before the age of social media, by the way. So it isn't even clear if I wrote something really terrible, how anybody would even find out about it? Like, right. They'd email it to each other? Like, what would they do? And so I was just doing because I liked it. And at that point, there was no conveyor from blogging to journalism. And also, I had no intention of being a journalist. So it wasn't like – not only was it low because nobody was reading – but it was also low because it wasn't meant to lead to anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was literally in my head a hobby that was no different from reading a book or going out on a run or playing video games or whatever it might be. Like it occupied the same space in my sort of internal priority list. It's just the one that I really loved.
When did it start to feel like the stakes were increasing? Is that just audience or did something change with you?
So it began to feel like the stakes were increasing when people who I knew of were reading. So the first time this happened was when I was blogging in 2003. I think it's 2003. I had read Richard Ben Kramer's fucking amazing book about the 1988 election, What It Takes.
One of the greats.
And if you read that book, one of the views you will come away with is Gary Hart is really great. And Gary Hart was coincidentally thinking of getting into the 2004 race, running against George W. Bush. And so I, you know, in this moment when like some people were writing about how Dean was great and some people were really into Gephardt, or, you know, I was extremely unusually into Gary Hart. And so one of my 35 readers a day was Joe Trippi, the manager of the Dean campaign, who was a former Gary Hart staffer and was just somewhat, I think, baffled and amused that some kid somewhere was a big Gary Hart fan. And so when Gary Hart dropped out of the race, I write this sort of note like, fuck, Gary Hart's dropped out of the race on my blog. And Joe Trippi emails me and he's like, hey, do you want to come work on the Dean campaign or intern on the Dean campaign? So I go and do that. I was supposed to be there for a summer and I left after 6 weeks because it turns out I really hate working on campaigns.
Why?
I don't like supporting candidates. Because then, like, they do things that you disagree with and you just have to, like, shut up about it. So that didn't work for me. And that's around when I started getting a little bit more serious. It was clear I was not any good at campaign work, but people were starting to read my writing.
When did you start to say, like, this is the thing?
I think it was a Washington Monthly internship as much as it was anything. I mean, that was a great experience, and I was there at a really wonderful moment. So the Washington Monthly structure at that time was – it was edited, I think it still is, by Paul Glasteris, who's great. But it had these sort of – would always have these two rotating senior editors. And I think they were called senior editors, although they were always – like, and at that time they seemed very senior to me, but I think they're just 20-somethings.
Right.
At that time, it was Nick Confessori and Ben Wallace Wells. And Nick is at the New York Times, and he's an amazing political reporter. Ben is at the New Yorker now. And both of them are just like two of the most talented journalists I've ever known. And I had so much to learn from it. And I knew that like very, very quickly and very clearly. Like that just fit, you know, in the mm-hmm. way something's just fit. Like that just fit. And I was like, oh, like I would love to one day be, you know, a senior editor at the Washington Monthly. Like, it was the first time I'd been, like, near a job. It's like, I could totally see myself being that. Like, the only question was, could I, like, ever, you know, get to something like that?
So how'd you do it?
I just kept blogging a lot. but the real way I did it is that the American Prospect, which had a fellowship, I think it was a two-year fellowship. It was just, it was a great position. I don't know if they still do it. But it paid, like, nothing. You know, you would go, and I mean, it was like an apprenticeship, right? I mean, it was like grad school, but you got paid a little bit as opposed to paying a lot.
I think almost none of those things exist anymore.
None of the fellowships? I mean, we have fellowships here.
That's great. People should apply for
our writing fellowships. I mean, it's modeled very much off of that program. But the, you know, I applied for the fellowship. I applied actually in my junior year. At that point, like, I was blogging a lot, and school, like, I'd never fit in at school, like, ever. I'd moved to UCLA because I thought maybe I didn't like UC Santa Cruz that much. It turned out I just didn't really like college, and I really had hated high school. So it seemed like maybe...
Didn't like the people?
Well, the people were great, and I still have, you know, some really good friends from that period. I do think I have a genuine problem listening to people lecture. Like, even now, as a journalist, I will not call into a teleconference call because I cannot absorb the information. Like, I just – there's something about that that doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And so much of school is just sitting and listening to someone lecture. I learn really well from reading. I learn really well from talking to people. There's a lot of ways I can absorb information, and that one just – it genuinely doesn't work for me. So I applied. It was actually my junior year, and it was really lucky that I did because they ran out of money the next year and canceled the fellowship for a year. So if I had waited until I was a senior, as I should have, I wouldn't have gotten it. But I got the fellowship, and so I like had some extra credits. So then I took this like big summer load and, you know, graduated college early and came out to D.C.
By the end of your time there, when like these editors from the Post started calling and like taking you out to lunch, at that point, did you have a more clear handle on where you wanted to be?
The Washington Post and Time magazine, sort of like both at once, became interested in me, which blew my fucking mind at that time. It's hard to sort of explain this, but that world of small policy magazines, which is shrunken now, was very consuming. And in my head, you know, maybe one day I'd like edit one of those magazines, right? Like I kind of thought of myself as a writer in that world. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe one day after I edited one of those magazines, I could one day go to somewhere like the Washington Post. Like the leap from like being at the American Prospect to being at the Washington Post was way too big to even think about. Uh-huh. And so that's like I think another good example where one reason that doesn't feel strategic to me is that I didn't go out and find it. Like, that was literally, like, they reached out and I was stunned
right.
and super excited. I wasn't looking for a job and did not expect that if I had gone looking for a job at the Washington Post, I would have found one.
Was it different when you left the Post to start this?
Yeah, very much. At that point, I had an idea for Vox and I had built out a plan. I had partners in that. Like, that was very much, I had a plan and I was trying to follow it.
How long were you working on the plan?
For Vox?
Yeah.
I had a lot of these ideas in my head, and a lot of them had come up like in isolated ways, like in product requests and different things. Mm-hmm. There was actually a blog post somebody sent me later that I wrote in 2009 at the Post. It was almost a perfect blueprint for Vox, and I'd completely forgotten about it. Like, and I wouldn't remember those ideas until like 2.5 years later or three and a half years later. But from when things clicked, and I was like, oh, like I want to build something that can do this, to like when I left, it was probably like 6 months.
Help me understand how you started to have those ideas. I understand there's like pieces here and pieces there, but when did it start to become something that you were like, okay, there's like a more cohesive idea here? And what was that idea?
So it was, I mean, this is probably, it's 2013 sometime. I remember very clearly a meeting with Marcus Broccoli, who was in the editor. I think it was maybe a business section meeting. And I pitched, you know, we should create like a wiki, but like one that we would do where when we're looking at a story that we cover continuously, we have some kind of deep explainer that is always attached to the art. Like I remember pitching this and mm-hmm. like, he was like, yeah, that's a good idea, you know, but these things are hard to build. They're really, really, really hard to staff. And I never thought anything more of it either. It's not like I was pushing it or something. The process from which it went to, I have some ideas to like, hey, like we should come up with a proposal. I don't like, this will sound like a cop out, but I don't exactly remember like what mm-hmm. the turning point was there. But, you know, at some point, I think there was some process that was begun about what is the future of Wonk Blog going to look like. I think it was as I was thinking about that, that was like, oh, it's not just more Wonk Blog. It was, I want to build product. Like I have some ideas for technologically how this could work differently. And if we could do that, then we could actually create something really different from anything that exists today. So it kind of began to spiral out from there. Like you had the kernel and you're like, well, what would it take to really do that? And the more you thought about organization, the more it was like, okay, it's not an evolution, it's a new thing.
Was that spiral exciting or like terrifying?
Exciting. Terrifying was when I actually tried to do it. Just thinking about things is great.
Yeah, super fun.
I can't recommend it highly enough.
Hey, I'm going to put Ezra on hold for a second and tell you a little bit about the sponsors who are making today's show possible. First up is Casper. And as you may have heard on this show, I live with a very small person who is my son, and he wakes up very early in the morning, which has made sleep very, very important to me. It is also very, very important to the people at Casper. They have engineered a incredible mattress at a shockingly fair price. It combines this springy latex and then this supportive memory foams to create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. Time magazine named it one of the best inventions of 2015, a mattress, one of the best inventions of 2015. It's a fantastic mattress, but most importantly, it's also a good deal. You can try it for 100 nights for free. It's free shipping, free returns. If you don't like it, send it back. They'll give you your money back. And it's not even that much money. That's the other part. Twin is just $500, $950 for a king. That's way under what you're paying at the mattress store. So go check them out. Go to casper.com/longform. If you put in the offer code longform at checkout, you'll get $50 off. $50 off an already great deal. Thank you, Casper. Thank you also to Squarespace. Squarespace is the best way, the simplest way, the only way to build a website in 2016. They've got these beautiful templates. They work on any device. Everything about Squarespace just kind of works. And it even works if you don't know any code. Everything's just drag and drop. You go to squarespace.com. You start building your website. You're just moving things around. Everything looks all pretty and nice. And you're like, I've got it. I've got my website for that store or portfolio or whatever you've been meaning to put on the internet. And you've not done because you thought it was hard. It is easy with Squarespace. When you decide to sign up for a year, which you will do because the product is fantastic, put in the offer code LONGFORM at checkout. You'll get 10% off and a free custom domain. Squarespace.com/longform. Squarespace, set your website apart.
What was it like? I mean, I remember just watching that process from afar, like when you left the Post, and then there was so much like attention.
Yeah, it was fucking weird.
To what you were going to do. What was it like?
Really frustrating and really unpleasant, like really unpleasant. So I had just not expected there would be, like, who fucking cared? I mean, it seemed to me maybe like a big deal to us and even to the Post, mm-hmm. but not to the media. Like, the people originally attached to the project were three people. Like, who cares? People move all the time. But yeah, there was a lot of, like, reporting on it. One thing that was very unnerving was how much of the reporting was wrong. I think people have this experience a lot where they're at the center of something that's getting reported on, and just, like, every story that came out. I remember this so clearly. The New York Times called me, and they said, like, we have heard that you asked the Post for, I think the number was $25 million. I was like, that's ridiculous. At that point, I don't believe I'd actually even asked the Post for a sum of money, but I could be wrong on that. And they're like, really? I was like, yeah, like, that number is, like, absurd. Like, what the fuck would you spend $25 million on? I don't think at this point in the organization we spend $25. I'm sure we haven't, actually. And like, okay. So then the piece came out, and it was eight figures. And then people just took that and then just kept saying $10 million.
Right.
But it was just wrong. And so that was frustrating and weird. But the thing that was really hard was that because of the because of the Politico experience that had already happened, and I also just think because of some cultural stuff in journalism, it was impossible to convince anybody that this wasn't some kind of searing critique of the Post. I actually really loved and love the Washington Post, like in a no bullshit way. And I just couldn't get people to stop writing this Politico narrative as some kind of either the Post was idiots for letting this go away
or you couldn't do something in a slow old machine.
A lot of like conflict as opposed to the way the process I think felt more from the inside, which is I had an idea. I brought it to them. What that idea needed did not fit with where they were, which I thought was completely the correct decision. Early on, when I was starting to think about this, the organizational structure under Don Graham was like, you had the Post, but you also had Slate, you had Foreign Policy, you had The Root. There was actually a precedent for the idea that you would have a institution that was connected to the mothership, but a little bit different. Mm-hmm. That's what I thought we would do. Then Bezos bought the Post, and those connections were severed. So now you just had the Post, and he was going to make a series of investments in the Post correctly.
What were those conversations with him like?
I didn't have any conversations with him.
Really?
Yeah.
No, not a one?
Not about this. No. I mean, I talked to him once when I was part of a roundtable of reporters when he came in, but never about this. Mm-hmm. These were conversations with people at the Post. And again, I think that was the right call. Like if I had been running the Washington Post and one of my reporters came to me and said, I have this plan to build this organization, but it would be separate from the Post. I mean, you could have some Post branding or whatever, but it would be run separately. And at the same time, I was just bought by a billionaire who probably had a limited period of time in which he would fund massive investment. I would not want to fucking divert that investment mm-hmm. into some other thing. So, you know, I think they basically like
it's time to
that
like
along.
Fix up the house.
Yeah, you fix up the house. Yeah. Correct. Again, like, and look, like,
it's working out.
It's working out. Like, that was the correct move. And, you know, and so those conversations like never really went to a money stage, mm-hmm. but they also weren't angry. Mm-hmm. And they weren't like, oh, you haven't let me do X. Like, they let me do a tremendous amount. And so the hard part about that process emotionally was that the reporting kept injecting conflict. Like, it was actually creating conflict in the process that, like, wasn't there and didn't need to be there. And that was really hard because, you know, I had a lot of, a lot of friends there and a lot of gratitude for the freedom and the support people had given me there. So that was a weird experience in that way. And then we just started with a lot of both it made it easier to succeed because people were paying attention. So when we did things that were good, it was great. But I had in my head always imagined that we would just like start some small thing over here and we'd have time to like build up and make our mistakes and whatever. And we started with a lot of attention on us, right? Like if we weren't changing the game from day one, what the fuck? And that was, you know, again, it might have been good in disciplining us and like forcing us to up our game faster, but that was a lot of pressure.
When you become like the center of a story like that and people are getting stuff wrong, does it make you think differently about this work?
Yeah.
How so?
To be fair, though, I did not come to that with the view that the press is unerring. And, you know, I'm sort of focusing a little bit, like I was focusing our conversation a bit on like a small like point of fact that in theory, if I had somehow wanted to correct everyone simultaneously, maybe could have been corrected. But I was just like really, like I really like did not talk about that process because I thought that was like, you know, the way to do it. And I think, by the way, the key people in the process didn't talk about the process. I think that what happened is there are a lot of rumors. But it was not shocking to me. Certainly as a blogger, I had a critique of the press. And I think that things are often conveyed in terms that are narrowly accurate and then conceptually inaccurate. Yeah, so, I mean, that didn't shock me, but it's definitely unnerving and it makes you wonder about your own work.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what I was asking. I mean, like, you know, I have never been in anywhere close like the limelight that you were in that moment, but or spotlight I should say, but I have this experience sometimes, like just when like the Sunday Styles comes out and they write about like a bar I know, you know, and it's just like, well, this is just wrong.
Well, you definitely have that experience living in DC, and then the New York Times occasionally writes about you.
parachutes in and writes about it, and there's this effect when you see something like that that you know really well and you see how sort of morphed and manipulated it has been to fit into that container. That's it. It throws into relief the whole rest of the package.
Yeah.
You know?
It was very frustrating to me. In important ways, it got the story wrong. But if you were, for some reason, a reader who actually was interested in this story, it probably didn't get the story wrong in ways that mattered tremendously to you, right? Like, it did get correct that, like, I was trying to start a new organization that ultimately wasn't going to be at the Washington Post. So I think that one thing that if I were to like maybe take the more generous view for the press, it's that the job of informing interested but not invested onlookers is actually different than the job of reporting for stakeholders. Now, to some degree, you probably should be trying to do both. But the fact that like it wasn't serving, it was frustrating to me, doesn't actually mean that, you know, again, for people who wanted to follow this, like they were learning something and it was broadly correct. It was just sort of its emotional valence had been turned upside down and some of the numbers were wrong. And like the only
pushback on that idea is that the number of people who are casual watchers of media news is pretty low.
Sure.
Like most of those people are staying.
Although, but to be fair, my sense of it is that it's everybody in the media and they actually are casual. You know what I mean? Like they actually, I think a lot of media news really is consumed as gossip.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that.
In that case, it might actually have been better. Like I think if what you were trying to do was consume that process as gossip, like the way they reported it was way better.
It was perfect. All right, so when you get in that 5-month period, you've left the Post and you, Matt and Melissa are sitting around trying to figure out what you're going to do. You start talking to all these different places, all these different umbrellas that you can do it under. How much of what you were thinking about was sort of business and entrepreneurial, and how much of it was the news side of what you were going to do and the way that you were going to try and dispense information?
Those were very connected. So one, a lot of this happened simultaneously. A lot of that 5-month period is while I'm still at the Post. In terms of planning, our theory of the case was that we had a pretty strong editorial vision and we actually were pretty confident in our ability to hire editorially. What we were not confident in, we had ideas about what we would need on the product and business sides, but we were not confident in our ability to build that. Like, I did not think that I had some kind of special talent, or really any of us did, and I think Melissa would agree, to hire CTOs. Right, she would have been a hell of a lot better at than I was, but way worse than Google is. And on business, none of us fucking knew how to hire a great director of ad sales. And so in terms of our strategizing, we did a lot of conceptual work early on the editorial plan. And after that, we were really trying to test partners in terms of could they support us on the product and business sides, because mm-hmm. that's where we really felt we'd be weak.
All of a sudden, you go from like a salaried employee at the Washington Post, which you had come to from being a very low salaried employee at the American Prospect. And all of a sudden now you're talking about equity and upside yeah. and potential numbers that are really big. And I wonder how much that was factoring into the way you were thinking, because it's hard for it not to.
We definitely thought about that stuff. I would say that stuff came very late in the process, and it wasn't the stuff we were thinking about early. So we spent a lot of time talking with partners, and 95% of the time spent in those conversations was practical. Mm-hmm. Like, how would we do this? Who would the CTO be? Like, all those kinds of issues. And it was only really at the end with Vox that we got into a serious discussion about numbers in terms of compensation. I mean, it's not that stuff didn't matter to us. It did. But as a general point, my belief from the beginning of this, and it's generally been my belief in my career, if we were at the place where we can make this succeed, then it would be lucrative. Mm-hmm. But if we went somewhere lucrative that did not have the right conditions to make it succeed, it would long run be actually worse. So, I mean, we had offers where right now I could be making many multiples of what I'm making right now. But those offers were from places that I don't think would have created the conditions for this to take off.
That's a good answer to that question. I guess, and maybe what I was thinking was there a point in there where you were like, holy shit, we could go and make a bunch more money than I ever thought I was going to be able to make doing this.
Yeah, although that actually point for me didn't come in this process. I had a period where I thought about really going into TV.
Yeah.
And TV has a very different pay scale than print. Well, yeah, that was another, I guess not print, but text.
Another media news gossip yeah. situation.
And that would have been a really big step change
yeah.
in income. And I didn't end up doing that.
Do you have any regrets about that?
No. So in terms of this discussion, these were not numbers that were like blowing my mind.
right.
People are not like, I mean, there could have been some good numbers here, but like people were not offering to pay the editor of like a digital, like primarily text media startup in 2004. Like it just like that wasn't, it wasn't the same as talking to networks about, well, what if I went TV full time?
How would you describe the bet that Vox as a whole is making?
We are making a bet that we're in a land grab period where there will be a certain group of massive publishers with competencies and business models that were really derived from digital. And this group will end up catching a tremendous amount of the brand advertising money that moves online. Does that make sense?
Completely.
Yeah.
That's the
bet. It's a lot of like kind of weird buzzy words, but I think they're the correct ones.
Well, I mean, to put it in slightly more like layman's terms, the bet is a lot of the current huge media companies are going to fall off and some new huge media companies are going to come up in their yeah. place, and Vox wants to be one of those companies.
Yeah, and Jim is a really good way, Jim Bankoff, the CEO, is a really good way of putting this. And he kind of, the way he explains it is that when the web arises as a sort of mainstream product or mainstream technology, you have sort of like what he thinks of as like MediaWeb 1.0, which is just sort of some people start putting content online in really crude ways. And then you have MediaWeb 2.0, which is you get really low quality but high volume publishers, right? They figure out that the cost of publishing is super low, so they create big content farms, right? Your about.coms, like that's what you're thinking about there. And he thinks then, like, you know, as people figure out the technology, as the legacy players get a bit smarter, you end up in a space where you're actually going to have a fight, as you do in every technology that matures, for premium brands, right? As it moves from being amateur to being professionalized, but sort of like low, like professionalized versions of the amateur thing. Mm-hmm. And then eventually you have people figure out the technology and become like premium. And the idea is that, you know, Vox Media will be the something like the Condé Nast of digital publishing. We have a portfolio approach where we have The Verge and we have Eater and we have SB Nation and we have Polygon and Curbed and Eater and Recode and React. And, you know, all these sort of brands that in their space are meant to be premium leader brands. Mm-hmm. And so they can get great advertising in that space and they get like a really valuable audience in that space and they build like a strong brand. And maybe some of them might have TV shows, some might have conferences, some might have, you know, podcasts, some might, you know, there are all different ways it can go. But I think that's the theory, and that, you know, there is a set of skills that will be rewarded online. And, you know, Vox Media has been one of the places. I think BuzzFeed is another, Vice is another, you know, who have been learning and figuring out and showing that, you know, we have those skills. And so, like, that there actually is space to win off of that.
Do you think that there's a better chance that that will play out and some number of digital media companies will end up winning and Vox won't be one of them, or that that won't play out and there won't be big media brands like 8 years from now?
Are you asking me to choose between, is it likelier that this happens but Vox loses, or it's just the reason Vox loses is it doesn't happen?
That's right.
Oh, definitely the first one.
More likely that it happens.
This definitely will happen. It's definitely already happened.
You think so?
Yeah. Vice has a $2 billion valuation.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, and they make real money, is my understanding. We make real money. Like, we're profitable. Mm-hmm. BuzzFeed makes real money. I know there's been talk about whether they hit their estimates, but there's been no talk that they didn't make a shit ton of money.
No, they're making money.
Yeah, so this is already happening. I think it's unlikely Vox Media won't be, you know, in that hopefully winner's circle, but definitely, I see almost no chance that there's not going to be a set of digitally native media organizations mm-hmm. that become huge businesses. I mean, I would put the odds of that at zero.
Zero?
Yeah.
I would put them above zero. All right. I'm going to adjust my scenario, I think, because I don't feel pessimistic about it. That's not what I'm saying.
Yeah.
The thing that I feel about it is that I genuinely can't paint the picture for you of what 2022 is going to look like from a media landscape. And I'm inherently dubious of anyone who says they can, because it's changed so rapidly in the last 8 years. So is the landscape shifting so fast that even the places that think of themselves as new and digital and agile can't be new enough, digital enough, or agile enough?
I think people overestimate the rate of change, structural change, in the media business. And I don't mean here change in how the business is conducted. There's no doubt that we're selling more ads online than we were. Like, that's all true. I mean the literal change in who the players are and how they are doing compared to some baseline. I think it is interesting, because sometimes I'll be talking to folks who want to come work here. And let's say, well, how do I know, you know, Vox will be around in 5 years? And the thing I always say to them is, name me someone who was around 10 years ago who isn't around today. Now, it's not that you can't name anybody. I don't want to suggest nobody has fallen out. And there's definitely been like an absolute reaping in like the mid-city newspaper section, right? Mm-hmm. Like in a way that's really, really, really terrible. But at the, you know, national player level, which is usually what we're talking about, right? And I think is what we're talking about in this case broadly. I'm actually struck by how much people stick around. I mean, Gawker is obviously going through some very tough times, but has been around from the beginning of this and remains like a big business, right? We'll see if they do. But what it takes to actually imperil them and their business appears to be like billionaires' endless vendetta lawsuits mixed with like them making some like really opening themselves up to huge legal reprisal, right? Like it's not that what happened is business changed. If there are no lawsuits and Peter Thiel never decided to like push his vendetta, that we'd be having no conversation about Gawker today. That we would just look at them and be like, yeah, they're doing their thing. Like they're making 40, 50 million, like whatever it is they make.
Yeah, not 100.
Yeah, not 100. But my point is just that there's a lot of stability actually.
Mm-hmm. Like my examples are like Newsweek. Well, that's not a good example.
But Newsweek actually is the example I would use too of like that is really something that fell apart. But it also like seemed to have like a lot of bad luck, right? Like it got sold to Harmon and he died really, really shortly thereafter. But I think if you're going to – if you're going to make the case, I think Newsweek is by far the best example.
Yes.
It's amazing. Like, it's actually not gone, but it, you know, it really isn't what it was.
Yes.
But a lot of the players are still around and still doing really well, actually. I actually think that we went through a period in the media where I don't think the legacy, non-legacy or new, old stuff actually makes that much sense anymore. Take the New York Times like or the Washington Post. I think they are doing stuff as innovative as what's happening at any of the new media players. In some cases, more innovative. And I think that for a while, you were seeing a real struggle in terms of like legacy organizations adapting. And I'm not saying there's no friction. I'm not saying there's no cost structures that aren't being supported. I mean, I don't want to say like all the pain is over. But I think that compared to where we were 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, it's like maybe these people, like maybe these institutions just won't figure out the internet. I don't think folks look imperiled in that way.
I agree with that. I also think that people are leveraged in a way that they haven't been before.
I'll hit another part of this that I think is interesting, though, that makes me – it's one reason I'm a little bit more optimistic about the business, although I think you could probably take the same point and argue it the other way. Something I think is interesting about the – digital media conglomerate hopefuls kind of group, the Vox Media Group, is that they're much more diverse in their at least aspirational revenue streams than their predecessors were.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Like the New York Times like published a paper.
Mm-hmm.
Like that was a fucking great business too, but it published a paper. Like that was primarily what it did. Washington Post is a little bit more complicated because of the way Graham Holdings was structured.
Kaplan and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, but the Washington Post, if you just think about it on its own terms, it published a paper. And I've always thought it's really interesting that the new media company, or at least the one we think of as a new media company, Vice, was like a small magazine for hipsters for a while first that we think of
for like at 20 years.
Yeah, so.
Yeah.
But has the highest valuation is fundamentally a television company at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And BuzzFeed is, you know, really moved into video, to motion pictures. Vox is really moving into video. You know, one interesting thing about the way a publication evolves online is that because the cost of creating different kinds of content is so much lower, right? You don't have to invest in television production in order to make videos. They end up having a lot of different competencies, or at least the ones that are, you know, getting high valuations and getting a lot of investment have a lot of different competencies. And in theory, have a lot of different revenue streams. It seems new to me, and it seems new to me in ways that suggest a little bit less long-term fragility.
I think that's right. It's also ambitious.
It is very ambitious, and it may not work. Let me argue the other side of it for a minute. I think that if any of these big players collapse, when their obits are written, it will be because they did too much. I'm not saying I think any of them in particular are doing too much,
mm-hmm.
but I do think when I look around and I think, what is the danger here? Like, what is the danger even for a Vox.com? I think it is losing too much focus because you're trying to do too many things. And I think one lesson everybody learned is be first to everything. Like, don't let somebody else, you know, beat you to the new platform.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody's on everything, and that's really hard.
It's hard for two reasons. It's hard to do everything just from like a 24 hours in a day, so only so many people in the office standpoint. But there's also this thing where it's like, if you bet on like every number on the roulette table, you can never really hit it that big. Like, there's only so much bandwidth, and it's going to be hard to get really, really good at any one thing if you're doing everything.
And I do think it's one reason that if you're doing a bunch of things, you have like there really has to be a thread on an editorial level. So
what's your thread?
To speak for Vox.com, right? Like we do explainer journalism. That's our mission. That's our culture. That's the stuff we're good at. There's a lot of stuff we're not good at, but mm-hmm. we are, I believe, good at that. And so if we're going to do something like go into television, if we're going to do something like go into make a big investment in some kind of new platform, we have to have some editorial theory about why our competency around explainer journalism will translate here, right? Is there a space in the market for it? Is there a need in the market for it? And is there some reason to believe that the capabilities of this technology will really work for it?
Mm-hmm. We started off and you were talking about how all of these sort of moves that you've made, the way that your career has evolved, has been driven by some urge to do something that you can't currently do. Is explainer journalism a big enough bucket that you are not going to run into like the walls of it anytime soon?
Oh God, yeah. If anything, it'll be the opposite. I'll give up because it's too hard. I'm not just being facetious. Doing the thing we're trying to do well is really hard. It is the hardest thing I have ever done by orders and orders and orders of magnitude.
Why?
Because I think people really underestimate how hard it is to change workflow and approach. Like take Cardstax, which is something that is, you know, a product we launched with. It's still one of the things we do. It's not, for all kinds of reasons, I don't think it'll be like our main hallmark on the world, but we still do them. But when we were like really trying to make that our main product, like trying to recreate the workflow, even in a world where we had like brought everybody in to do that, we more or less got there, but it was grueling. To try to both be reporting the news and keeping these like body of knowledge products updated. Like it was, and for the ones where we're, you know, still focusing on them, is grueling. It's really difficult. And, you know, there's a lot of herd mentality in journalism. I don't mean that in a bad way. There is in everything. There are ways people are used to doing things. And, you know, doing just good work, even at the most normal level, is really hard. And then trying to do good or great work in ways that are more idiosyncratic is really, really hard. And like one, it means there are things you're not going to do well, right? Like Vox is not a leader in breaking news. We are just not optimized for that. And like, that's a choice.
Mm-hmm.
When we are at our best is I think we have developed a lot of styles and contexts and formats and approaches and internal processes and all kinds of shit to surface context in ways that are not usual in journalism. That's what I think actually connects a ton of the different things we do.
Mm-hmm.
Like I often think about like, what is our product? And I think that it is not the nugget of broken news. Like what we're trying to make our product is the context. And I don't just mean random bits of information. I mean like the model, the body of knowledge, the thing that as the expert journalist allows us to understand the new information. And surfacing that like every time and figuring out how to surface that and creating ways to surface that is really hard. It's a thing I think we're best at. And even though I think we're better at that than anybody else in the game, I think we only get it right a fraction of the time.
Mm-hmm. And it's impossible to imagine yourself getting bored until you're doing it every time.
Yeah, boredom will not be the problem.
I have one more question I want to ask you.
Yeah.
We did that whole thing. I did not ask you about any feature writing that you ever did on the Long Form podcast. I feel sheepish about that. Like you wrote New Yorker pieces. We didn't even talk about it. Do you miss the New Yorker pieces?
I do miss getting to do like the work of Long Form more frequently. Like the main thing I miss is not long form or short form or any kind of medium. I get to do actually a fair amount of writing. It is the learning that comes from it. Like the reason doing those New Yorker pieces was fun is I learned a shit ton. I always thought of the real role that doing long form played in my work as not about the feature itself, but about the 100 blog posts that would be informed by that feature.
Right.
That was where the real value was. And I wish in this podcast, maybe we'll do another one sometime, we had talked a bit more about this part, because I think it's something I believe really strongly about journalism, that repetition is really important, and that what you're trying to do is develop a certain set of models about the world and ideas about the world. And then you're using different news events to like highlight them from different angles. And, you know, I covered a lot of bills, and underneath the way I covered that legislation was a model of how Congress works, of how politics happens in this country, what polarization is doing. And I think I was ultimately able to really inform a lot of people, not through individual posts on the legislation, but through the consistent impact of seeing that day's bit of news evaluated from these angles. And I'd use feature work to work out the models. And that always, I think, refreshed my work a lot. And what I worry about is, what am I writing in 4 years?
Mm-hmm.
When I'm like really like have not been doing this for a while. So that's what I miss. I don't miss so much, you know, the act of publishing in The New Yorker, though obviously that's super cool. But I miss reporting and like thinking through things at that level.
At least you got podcasting.
I do. At least we'll always have podcasting.
Ezra, thanks for taking the time, man.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Our editor this week was Janelle Pfeiffer, our intern Courtney Harrell. Thanks to our sponsors, MailChimp, Squarespace, and Casper. And thanks very much to Ezra Klein for letting me come hang out in his office for a while. If you enjoyed that conversation, then I guarantee you will like Ezra's podcast. Check it out. There's a link in the show notes. We'll see you next week.
Rate us on iTunes.
Aaron would like you to rate us on iTunes, please.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.